We are beginning the public hearing on offshore wind. How would you like to define it? Is that sufficient enough?
Sure, yes.
And this is the Energy, Utility, and Technology Committee. And I'm going to have people introduce themselves, starting from my very right.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. My name is Sophie Warren, and I'm fortunate to represent a small but mighty portion of Scarborough.
Good afternoon. My name is Jim Boyle. I represent House District 109, the eastern portion of Gorham.
We'll go to my left.
Good afternoon. My name is Jerry Runte, and I represent District 146.
Good afternoon, Representative Valley Geiger. I represent District 42, Rockland, most of Owl's Head, and the islands of North Haven, Matinicus, Creehaven, and the Muscle Ridge.
Good afternoon. I'm Larry Dunphy. I represent District 72.
Good afternoon. I'm Steve Foster from Dexter. I represent District 32.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Paige Ziegler. I'm the House Chair of EUT, and I represent District 40. And if you would introduce yourselves, and you can start to present.
I'm Selena Cunningham, Deputy Director in the Governor's Energy Office.
I'm Ethan Tremblay, Policy and Markets Program Manager in the Governor's Energy Office.
And with that, Senator Lawrence, Senator Representative Ziegler, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to present to you today on the work of the offshore wind in the state of Maine. Maine has one of the best offshore wind resources in the country, and offshore wind can not only provide clean power to Maine and New England, but also be a major economic driver for Maine. And you should have, I think, slides and the roadmap in front of you. Hopefully people do. Great. And so today I'd like to spend some time talking to you about the offshore wind roadmap, which you have before you, which was released last year. And it builds on over a decade of work that has taken place in the state on research and development and planning, relationship building, and work in the state on offshore wind. The roadmap reflects a multi-year extensive stakeholder process that charts a path forward for offshore wind in Maine in the near and long term. The offshore wind industry is growing. It has realized $13.5 billion in private investment so far, with $70 billion planned over the next decade. As a part of Maine's 10-year economic development strategy, and with nearly 80 current or companies in Maine that are either now engaged or positioned to engage in the offshore wind industry, Maine has an opportunity to gain from this growing economic sector, which aligns with some of our existing state strengths, including our long-time maritime history. Our research institutions have already recognized the opportunities this sector will bring to our state and have positioned Maine as a leader in research and development and innovation in offshore wind technology. Equally important in the advancement of offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine is that it is done so in a way that benefits Maine people and preserves and respects existing ocean users in the vibrant Gulf of Maine ecosystem. Before I get into the roadmap, I want to spend some time talking about the Maine Offshore Wind Initiative, as well as a brief overview of the technology of floating technology. We'll also talk about offshore wind from an energy perspective and how it fits into our overall energy mix. The goal of today's conversation is to give you an overview of the offshore wind work that we've been doing in the in the state of Maine. Have time to answer your questions, and we'll pause at a few points to ask. To offer questions. There's a lot of information here, so we're happy to either come back or talk to individual members to help you understand the work that we've been doing or questions that you may have. So with moving to the next slide, with bipartisan support, the legislature has taken a number of steps to enact climate change and renewable energy requirements. This includes climate and clean energy requirements related to 80% by reaching 80% by 2030. In addition, the governor has set a goal of reaching 130,000 clean energy jobs by 2030. Maine will need significantly more renewable energy over the next 30 years, and we are pursuing a diverse portfolio to achieve that. So in 2019, at the request of New Hampshire, the Gulf of Maine picked up steam around planning for offshore wind development. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is a federal agency tasked with offshore energy leasing, established a federal state task force, the Gulf of Maine Task Force, which Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts are state members. To ensure that Maine's interests were represented in that federal state conversation, the governor established the Interagency Maine Offshore Wind Initiative, which GEO convenes with Department of Economic Development, Department of Marine Resources, IFNW, Department of Transportation, Maine International Trade Center, and Maine Technology Institute, just to name a few of the state agencies that are involved in this work. We coordinate across state agencies and all the offshore wind efforts that we embark on. And really, I think we're working to overall achieve moving away from fossil fuels, supporting Maine's thriving ocean businesses and communities, and creating additive economic opportunities and family supporting jobs in the state of Maine. So just a few of the initiatives, the different components of the initiatives that we'll spend some time talking about today is around planning and stakeholder engagement. That's a key focus of all of the work that we've done over the last several years and integral in the roadmap. In terms of policy and legislation, two laws passed in 2021 related to offshore wind. The first one is authorizing language for, authorizing the Public Utilities Commission to review and approve a power purchase agreement for the Maine Research Array. This is a proposed project that would be up to 12 turbines in federal waters, about 40 miles off of Portland. And the goal of this, the state is embarking on seeking a research lease for this project. And the goal of this research project is to help inform, make sure that we understand the impacts of offshore wind to make sure that we can protect the fishing industry, the Maine ecosystem, and maximize economic opportunities from these projects. And so that planning effort is under that research lease is before the federal agency that we submitted it to, and the legislation supports that. In addition to that, there was 1619, which prohibits commercial offshore wind in state waters, which are 3 miles from the coast. In addition to that, the 1619 also established a Maine Research Consortium to help us to provide a pathway to answer some of these fundamental questions. And so in addition to research and innovation, which we focus on Maine-based technology and working to continue to answer some of these questions that the state has, we also focus on partnerships, recognizing that Maine is just a piece of this puzzle. We need to work regionally when it comes to planning, learn from other places, whether it be from European countries that have already embarked on offshore wind, working to address and learn from one another. So that's a key part of all of our work that we do here. So turning to the next slide, slide 5, I want to take a few minutes to walk through the technology. And in this slide, you'll see that here are some fixed and floating turbines. On the left are the fixed bottom foundations that are literally fixed to the seafloor. They can be used in relatively shallow waters. On the right are some of the different types of floating platforms, which we'll need in the Gulf of Maine due to the water depths. Each floating type has different pros and cons, and there are currently about 50 different technology designs that are out there, including the University of Maine's Volturnus semi-submersible floating technology. That technology is made, or that foundation is made out of concrete, which has the benefit of being able to be made locally here in Maine. The type of technology used will depend on a variety of factors, including the type of seabed, water depth, and other components. So the industry is growing rapidly, but these are the types that you'll see used likely in the Gulf of Maine. Moving to the next slide. In this picture, you'll see, this is a picture of a fixed platform, but you will see that the turbine is connected to the seafloor. And these are similar to land-based turbines with a few differences. Generally, offshore turbines are much larger. The floating turbine would be fixed to a foundation, and then with mooring lines connected and anchored to the seabed. For any project, there would be a transmission cable connecting the project, usually to a substation for commercial projects, and then to an onshore substation. The transmission cable is buried under the seabed at about 6 feet, wherever possible. The image you see here is a 12 megawatt turbine. And in terms of size, this turbine is 850 feet tall with blades that are 350 feet long. One rotation of one turbine can power an average household for nearly 2 days. So just to give you a sense of the scale of these projects. And there are thousands of components of a single offshore wind turbine, which, you know, I've highlighted some of the larger ones in this picture, but that it just gives you a sense of the supply chain that will need to be developed in the US to help build these projects. Globally, offshore wind is advancing rapidly. And as you can see here, it's continuing to do so over the last decade plus. And projects are growing in size. And China recently announced the world's largest project, which is 43 gigawatts. It will be constructed in 2025. And it's anticipated that the industry will bring $1 trillion worldwide by 2040. The floating offshore wind sector is earlier in its development, but equally continuing to build place to increase in pace. And we have the opportunity to capitalize on our decades plus work on floating offshore wind to take advantage that to create these long-term family supporting careers in Maine and learn lessons to minimize impacts. And so looking at slide 23, this is a picture of different lease areas and activities in federal waters. And I included this just to give you a sense of the activity that is happening already in the US. And as the industry grows, the interest in floating technology in the US will eventually get to an estimated 60% of the entire US market will be floating technology. So as nearshore waters on the shelf fill up, the folks will be looking further offshore. So in 2021, the Biden administration announced a goal of 30 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2030. In addition to that, the administration outlined a number of lease sales. It's hard to read, but the very last bar there is the Gulf of Maine. A commercial lease sale in the Gulf of Maine is scheduled for the third quarter of 2023. And after the lease sale, there'll be a number of years for planning and permitting before projects are constructed. But the work that we've been doing over the last 2 years to get input from stakeholders and help shape our overall roadmap plan will help inform the engagement that we do within the federal process. So just to talk a little bit about the federal commercial leasing process, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management within the Department of the Interior is in charge of federal offshore energy leasing and approving construction and operation plans for offshore wind. There is a separate agency that is tasked with environmental and safety enforcement. And right now we're in this blue box area here. The federal government is doing planning and analysis in preparation for a lease sale. There'll be a competitive auction in any for a number of areas. That number is not yet set by the BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management. And then leaseholders will need to advance through site assessment, construction, and operation phases, which can take another 4-6+ years. Did you have a question?
I just wanted to orient folks to the slide we're on. It says 9 on the bottom. Oh. Some of them have numbers off, but it says renewable energy authorization process. It's kind of a rainbow gradient bar chart.
Our slides are not numbered correctly.
Ours is different than yours. So.
Oh.
Unless I'm looking at the wrong page.
It's just small.
Yeah, well, ours
is like this.
I'll show you occasionally.
You're on exactly the right page. Much.
We've got the special version, and you guys don't.
Right,
large print.
I'll get the poster board.
Simple words, no more than one syllable. Thanks.
So taking a step into the planning process, you can see on the top of the slide here, the red chart or the red boxes. The BOEM is in the draft call stage. And this is a winnowing process where they take a larger area and then over the course of months and years will then narrow down to a specific area that they will then include in in the auction. And so we're kind of a third of the way through in terms of the process there. So the slide with the map, this is what BOEM has released in terms of a draft call area. And it's important to note that this is not what they're intending to see development all over this, but what they use this for is to get input from the public, from states, stakeholders looking at fisheries and wildlife data to help inform future winnowing of this area. The state, and one thing to note is that it is 20 miles from the coastline. That's a first step that they made, which is I think important to protect some of our important fisheries. In addition to that, you can see in some of the governor's energy office coordinated comments across state agencies to make sure that we were bringing in views from our roadmap process, from stakeholders and from agencies when communicating to BOEM. And so we put forward a lengthy comment letter in the last filing, and we'll continue to do so to advocate for Maine interests in the future actions from the federal government. And so with that, I'm happy to take questions, and then we can move on to
Representative Dunphy.
Thank you. I have three or four, if I may just continue on. Is that all right with you?
We're not in a formal hearing or anything, okay. So this is just a presentation.
Okay.
So I'm going to turn you loose and let you run wild.
Really?
Yeah. Yes. All of you. All of you.
All of you. So impact of concrete on the ocean bed. Can you tell me approximately how many cubic yards per turbine?
I'm happy to get back to you in terms of the total, you know, the diameter of the foundations.
Well, you can either do that, or you can tell me the cubic yards required for the foundations. I can calculate if you give me the dimensions. Cable 6 feet deep. What's the impact? You're looking at 20 miles out, right? And then coming into shore at 6 feet deep. For burying the cable.
Thank you for the question. So there are couple of steps to this. One is that when BOEM set the 20 miles, that was a beginning stage in their planning. There's more, they're going to take more information and decide the specific area. So it may be further than 20 miles, but when it just say that in terms of the cable laying process, the best practices are to bury a cable 6 feet deep. Mm-hmm. And then where not able to bury, you can use mattressing and other techniques. In terms of impacts, when my understanding is when people follow the appropriate steps, the impacts can be minimal. One of the things that we've heard in our conversations throughout Maine is that there is an interest in understanding the impacts not only from transmission cable. So it's something that we're thinking about from the consortium's perspective of how can we make sure that we understand the full impacts of transmission cables.
So 850 feet tall is with 300 and something foot blades. Can you tell me what the max RPM is that you can operate?
We're happy to get you back to you with that to answer that question.
Okay. And can you tell me what the capacity factor is of the turbines?
In the 40s in the Gulf of Maine,
40%
speaking, 40 to 50%, somewhere in that range, depends on where they're located, the size and height of the turbine and other stuff.
Okay. But you're limited. Limited at that size to a max. I mean, the RPMs are going to become an issue. It's not necessarily the wind; it's the velocity, tip velocity. Is that?
Yeah, which would be, I mean, it's a function of the wind speed and other factors. But yes.
Okay. Okay. And you had mentioned about communities. I've heard a lot of comments, and there is a question here. I've heard a lot of comments from especially the lobster industry. And I'm curious, are we putting policy ahead of the desires of what Maine people want? And if we are, why are we? And if we're not, then I'm puzzled why the lobstermen, and it seems to be a pretty massive movement. I wonder why their issues aren't being addressed. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I want to first say that the central to the work that we do on offshore wind is really thinking about impacts and opportunities for Maine, but in terms of the fishing industry, the impacts. We know that there are 16,000 commercial fishermen in Maine, that it's an important part of our economy with $1.5 to $2 billion of direct and indirect economic benefit to the state. So in any work that we do, it's important that we not only work to minimize, but work directly with the fishing industry to understand specific concerns. When we first started talking about offshore wind in 2020 in the context of the research array, we heard concerns about nearshore projects in the Gulf, in state waters. The governor introduced legislation to specifically address that then passed in terms of the prohibition in state waters, which represents 70 to 75% of the lobster industry. We know that there are continued to be concerns about offshore wind when it comes to lobster industry and their fisheries. And that's why we are very appreciative of the time that the members of the fishing industry put into the roadmap process to come up and develop specific strategies and recommendations of how to build this industry in a way that, while they may not, I totally understand that some people will not support it, but we can work to address concerns and minimize impacts through continuous dialogue and listening to the feedback that we've gotten.
Representative Dunphy?
Yeah. So there have been a number of whales found dead in New Jersey. They don't think it was the mob. So can you tell me if any of this is related to what's going on with the offshore generation there?
So a few things. One is I want to make sure that the federal and state agencies who have an expertise in whales can speak to that specific question. So let me get back to you and with some specific information. But more broadly, we know that the lobster industry and others have taken a lot of steps for decades here to make sure that they are minimizing risk to whales. And so any work that we do in terms of advancing new technologies, we need to be mindful of that and also make sure that we're not creating additional challenges, not only for whales, but also for other industries in the advancement of offshore wind. We have supported the efforts and encouraged the federal government. They're working on a NOAA and BOEM strategy of addressing specific concerns around right whales. That work is absolutely important, and we want to make sure that in the planning process, the federal agency is listening to the data that NOAA, DMR, and others have to make sure that any impacts are fully considered and when the whales and are protected.
Another one, Representative Dunphy, another one, go ahead.
So one of the concerns, as I understand it, is cables, is lines for the lobster fishermen. Whale entanglement was one of the issues. So I was looking at some of the anchorings here, and it looks like there's a lot of cable. How do you, in your collaboration, rationalize a line is a line in my world?
It's a really important question. So the BOEM has done some research and analysis around floating technology and whales. And what I think we understand is that the size and scale, I'm sure if Dr. Dogger was here, he'd show you the scale of these mooring lines are so large that the impacts would be different than other types of lines in the ocean. There are, I think, concerns from secondary entanglement and things like that we want to be thoughtful about how whatever we're putting in the ocean, we want to make sure we have those understand those interactions and minimize risk. And that will be part of the permitting process for BOEM to understand that. In addition to that, that's why the state is also pursuing the research array so we can help answer some of these fundamental questions about impacts to offshore wind. Lastly, I'll say in our partnership with we work closely with or tried to work with international partners to understand of the existing floating projects, how can we learn what's happening there where possible?
Thank you. And just to give people on the committee a heads up, there may be a certain senator on this committee who has a offshore wind procurement bill coming in this session. I think we did a press conference on it. So we're going to have a chance to look in detail on a lot of these issues on impact and things like that. So that will be coming in the future. I'm not going to reveal which senator it is, but and just to add one quick question, you were talking about the technology, and I think Representative Dunphy was talking about, size and things like that. Am I correct in my understanding that by the time we get to the point where these actually go in the water, the technology may have changed even further? So height dimensions may change as we go along.
That's a really good point. A little bit later, I have a slide that shows that the turbine size is increasing. It will max out at some point, but the industry is developing rapidly, and we are seeing changes in technology. So those numbers will change. Thank you.
Representative Ziegler.
Yes, and doing the preliminary work, will they be using any seismic profiling like they use in oil exploration, which does affect whales to a great amount?
So thank you for the question. Seismic for offshore wind is a different depth in terms of than oil and gas, because when you're trying to see what's well below the seabed, you used more intense seismic. I'm happy to get you a little bit more detail, but it's using a different type of geotech work there. It will be a part of the process to understand how to site the transmission cable and where to put the platform. So that is something that will take place. It will require permits from NOAA and as well to make sure that those will not impact whales.
Can I follow? Just a quick one. So in essence, it'll have a less probably of a noise possibility than offshore oil exploration, and you're probably using a combination of sonar and I assume some seismic work. So it should be more benign than perhaps oil exploration. That's not a question. That's a sort of almost a statement.
That's a better answer to your question. So thank you.
Other questions, comments, Representative Foster?
I have a couple, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know of any oil exploration going on in the Gulf of Maine? Next question. I had to step out because for a moment, so I missed the mechanical engineering portion of your presentation. I'm wondering, how many gallons does one of these generators hold of, I would guess, turbine oil?
We're happy to get back to you that specific question.
I've always been curious. I don't know the answer to the.
I think it's
this
pretty,
size,
but I can get the specific number.
Other questions, thoughts, Representative Warren?
Thank you for coming. If you could talk a little bit about the stakeholder process a little further. I know that there's been in recent years that I think it's a 10-year moratorium in state waters of offshore wind. I know that there's been some concerns expressed in the process with the fishing community, for example. How have you modeled your stakeholder process? What have you learned from those that might be in opposition? And how has that changed your strategy as you've gone forward?
Thank you for the question. So first, I'll just say that it is a prohibition on commercial offshore wind in state waters. I am happy to just say broadly that we have engaged in extensive stakeholder process through the siting of the proposed research array, as well as through the roadmap process. We're going to get into that in a couple of slides, so I might hold that and ask you if you have additional questions after we get through that, go in more detail on our stakeholder process, if that's okay.
Representative, you can go.
Thanks. In this, I'm looking at the draft call area. It's a kind of a green area that you've outlined here. Can you tell us, are there going to be fixed platforms likely to be installed in that area? It's my understanding that the seabed is deep enough that it would likely be off. It would be floating technology, as in the two slides you compared the two. But can you talk a little bit about what's likely to go there, whether there would be any fixed, concrete in the seabed there?
Thanks for the question. We anticipate that it'll be entirely floating technology given the water depths in the Gulf of Maine.
Any follow-up, Representative Boyle? Other questions or information at this point before they continue? Senator Grochowski.
Thank you. Just trying to see if this is the right time to ask or not, but because we expect that ultimately there will be a lot of cables, and they don't all need to run straight to shore, but there could be substations, for instance. I remember hearing something about like a multi-state collaboration on planning and mapping. Can you give us an update, or if it's appropriate later, that's fine too, but on the ways the Governor's Energy Office is participating in regional planning around this?
Yes, thank you for the question. I'm happy to answer that now. We can breeze over it later. So Maine is participating with other New England states in a multi-regional planning effort around transmission, specifically looking at issues related to offshore wind, but also there's offshore transmission. There's obviously implications for onshore. And so we are certainly interested in this. Is the reason why this has been a multi-year effort to take a look at how we can work collectively to support coordinated transmission. Originally, projects were had radio lines from one project going to shore. When you're thinking about the type of build out that we're going to have on the East Coast, it's more effective to have coordinated transmission where you have a backbone and then multiple projects are interconnecting. And as you said, would then go to shore through a substation. And so that is, I think, ideally where we would like to go. We need to continue to working with ISO and the states to determine how best to do that. But I know the Maine PUC, Governor's Energy Office, and other state governments are coordinating on talking about how to maximize federal dollars to continue advancing that.
Go ahead, Senator Orhovsky.
Thank you. I'm really encouraged to hear that, because when I think about like impact on fisheries, for instance, the farther out, you know, the majority of the infrastructure is, I think the less impact that will have. I just would say, if there's anything that the legislature can do to help or to communicate with our colleagues that are in other states to try to have that be as efficient as possible for ratepayers, as well as, you know, for the affected folks that are in the inshore areas, like, please do let us know that.
Thank you.
And since Representative Warren.
Maybe as part of that, and maybe now is not the right time, but in so far as you're doing regional work, are you also doing that kind of more local work? I've heard from different representatives from maybe directly or indirectly impacted communities potentially. And there's been a bit of critique about the lack of coordination or communication, but maybe that's with time it's improving, or you've got a plan around that to bring people in or make sure they know ways that they'll benefit. So again, this may not be the best time, but curious about that on the more local level as well.
Yeah, transmission is obviously a really important conversation to have. And I think maybe one, so I'd say that under the roadmap process, there were, was conversation around transmission when it comes to minimizing impacts of fisheries, looking at in the environment, as well as how to make sure that you have enough certainty from a business perspective to be able to connect projects as well. So I think that maybe that one of the issues is that we will continue to do some, we did some technical analysis for our roadmap that outlines some key components of how transmission works and how different coordinated transmission can move forward. And so I think over the next year, the Governor's Energy Office, in coordination with other state agencies, will want to take a look at how do we bring these pieces together, doing the technical analysis we already have. And as also thinking about from a regional perspective, how can we advance this conversation locally? And so I think it's more of a product of where we are in the time, given that we don't yet have projects fully developed here in the Gulf of Maine. And so that will come in time.
Can you follow up? Following up on Senator Grahowski's question, this just to put a bug in your ear to the GEO, I'm sure. And I've heard the talk about a coordinated hub and a single transmission line coming in. But I'm sure in this process, and I'd encourage everyone to think about in this process, there's also security concerns, given what went on with the Nord Stream pipeline and whether, you know, using a central hub makes it more susceptible to attack or disruption or things like that. I'm sure that's something, you know, that ISO and BOEM would consider in that process too as well. But I just want to put that bug in the back of your mind in those discussions. Perhaps you can clarify for me too. No leases have been granted, and I'm thinking maybe they'll do 3 to 5 possibly in this area. But my understanding is on the West Coast, they've already begun granting leases for floating offshore wind. Is that correct?
Yes. Off the coast of California, a number of leases have been issued, and then there's a plan to lease in off the coast of Oregon as well.
Okay. And so are you guys watching that process and seeing what they're doing and seeing how they're approaching it?
Yes, we are part of a number of formal and informal coalitions to learn from one another and share information across coasts to work together on that.
Great, thank you. Why don't you go on with your presentation? Oops, I think. Oh, do we have a question at this point? Okay, why don't you continue on?
Thank you. So with that, Ethan.
So I'm going to take the next two slides. We're going to start. Just to orient folks, is a slide that says New England's over-reliance on fossil fuels drives high energy costs. It's got two charts on it. These are both from ISO New England. Says 12 in the bottom corner of my slide, and I hope it's actually slide 12. So Selena's talked about some of the BOEM process, giving you a little bit of a preview of the sort of economic opportunity that offshore wind provides for the state of Maine. I want to focus now a little bit on the energy side of things. So these charts are just to give you some context. I'm sure this much of this is familiar to many on the committee already, but as you can see, New England is over-reliant on imported gas-fired generation to produce our electricity, which leaves us vulnerable to price spikes like we've seen this year. Maine is also heavily reliant on polluting fossil fuels, particularly heating oil and kerosene for our heat and gasoline for our transportation. We send, as a state, more than $4 billion out of our economy to import fossil fuels annually. And obviously, they also contribute to climate change impacts that we're seeing throughout our state. So again, these are just charts from ISO New England to help illustrate those patterns that are existing in our energy system today. And then I want to point out that most other New England states are also working in similar fashions to Maine with the kind of policies that we're about to talk about to reduce their emissions and transition to renewable energy. And key to the offshore wind conversation, that means that the Gulf of Maine is seen as a resource for not just the state of Maine. Moving to the next slide, this is really just a refresher on the state's renewable portfolio standard. So this requires 80% of our electricity by 2030 to come from renewable resources. That's the end of this decade. The analysis that I'm going to show you that was conducted for the offshore wind roadmap looks not only at the RPS requirement through 2030, but also the existing statutory goal of 100% renewable energy by 2050. This slide also shows you some information regarding the recent results of the RPS, which includes producing more than $68 million of direct rate reductions for Maine people last year.
If you can do that on mic.
I know this slide, I could be seeing something wrong. Does it say governor announced 100% by 2040? Does that mean, I know you probably have done work on the by 2050, but is there a reason why that's mentioned on this slide? Is it, because I think you mentioned verbally by 2050, but I saw the slides at 2040, so just wanted to.
Yes, thank you for the question and happy to clarify that. So in law right now is a requirement and with associated penalties for 80% renewable energy by 2030. Also in law right now is a goal of 100% renewable energy by 2050. Earlier this year, the governor announced her intention to put forward a plan to move that 2050 goal up to 2040. So those are kind of the three things that I was mentioning there.
No, I appreciate that. I was aware of that. So I just wanted to clarify why is it included on this slide? Has the GEO done work based on that announcement? And that's why it's now updated here?
No, we did work, which I'm going to get to in a couple of slides, based on the existing 2050 goal.
Okay.
So yeah, the analysis that I'm going to show you here predates the announcement from February this year. The next slide, which says renewable energy market assessment at the top, this is also to remind the committee of the renewable energy goals market assessment completed by the GEO and released in 2020 as required by statute. Which is really sort of a starting point for the offshore wind needs assessment that I'm about to show you. That study, of course, did find that Maine is on track to meet our renewable energy goals, although we will need substantial additions of new renewables by the end of the decade in order to remain on track, among other findings. The next slide. So this is a chart that shows you Maine's projected electric load growth through 2050. This is analysis that was prepared for the Maine Climate Council, released in 2020. The key takeaway here is really that we expect Maine's electricity needs to more than double by the middle of the century. That's a result of increased electrification, people adding things like heat pumps, electric vehicles, new technologies that are entering the market and being adopted rapidly by consumers. And it really highlights to you that there are two pieces of this renewable energy need. One is to change the consumption that we have now to coming from renewable resources. And the second is to meet our additional needs as our load grows in the future. And so that's really kind of the two factors that are driving our needs for additional renewable resources. If you flip to slide 16, so this has a yellow. I don't know if the numbers are right. They do. Super. Thank you. So this slide says Maine's offshore wind needs. This is part of the technical analysis that was developed through the roadmap. So with significant feedback from stakeholders, the analysis determined a future scenario. First of all, a future scenario under which Maine could achieve our requirements using onshore renewable energy alone. any such scenario is highly implausible. It's also important to note that the analysis estimated annual renewable energy needs. So this is an annual basis. That's the way a renewable portfolio standard works. It did not take an additional step of looking at the amount of renewable generation capacity that might be needed to meet hourly demand. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. So this is kind of a higher level analysis, but the qualitative analysis that went along with this shows that offshore wind is likely to prove complementary to other renewables. And what we mean by that is that, generally speaking, offshore wind in the Gulf of Maine would produce the most at night and the most in the winter months when our electricity needs are expected to become the greatest. So it's complementary to the other sorts of renewables that the state and others in the region are also focused on deploying. The chart just shows you really two scenarios that were modeled in that study. On the left, those three bars showing expected renewable deployment in 2030, 2040, and 2050 are associated with what we call the diverse portfolio. That was really kind of the most plausible scenario that was modeled in that study and suggests that for Maine to meet Maine's need, we would need somewhere in the range of 2.1 to 2.8 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2050. That's obviously in concert with continued renewable development onshore, both wind and solar. This analysis did sort of use as a starting point, assuming that existing projects that are in development right now are completed. The other set of bars shows you a scenario we called constrained onshore development. This assumed that other than projects that are now sort of proposed and planned, if Maine were not to build additional new renewables after that onshore, we're looking at the additional offshore wind that we might need instead. The next slide, 17, says regional offshore wind needs.
We have a clarifying question from Senator Grachowski.
Certainly.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt. I feel like I used to know the answer to this question, but when we talk about, you know, above what is existing and planned, what is that universe? So does it include the offshore, like the Researcher Way, Northern Maine Transmission? I mean, I think this modeling actually happened before that, some of that.
So it does assume both of those. The Research Array project, 144 or so megawatts. And then I think the assumption used here was about 1,200 megawatts of onshore wind associated with the Northern Maine Renewable Energy Development Program, which you're all familiar with. So those are both assumed to have happened by the time this these 2040 and 2050 bars are created. So they're not reflected in this chart, but they are assumed to exist in that world.
And so the chart is just what's additional to that that would be needed.
Exactly.
Because this is the update to what was done 2 years ago.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
So then the regional offshore wind needs slide, it looks similar, but the bars are bigger. This was because, as I mentioned a minute ago, the Gulf of Maine, there are other states adjacent to the Gulf of Maine with substantial renewable energy needs that will also likely look. And so we wanted to, as part of the roadmap, understand what sort of the total deployment that we might see in the Gulf is for a range of, it's important to a range of stakeholders. The key takeaway here is really that New England is estimated to need up to 12 gigawatts of offshore wind from the Gulf of Maine. That is, I will say, probably on the lower end. Other states, of course, have their own energy planning efforts underway. There are other studies that you can look at and see the numbers that they're planning to. So we also did sort of a literature review and got an idea of what other states are thinking. And this is on the lower end, but give you a sense of the scale of development that's likely to be coming for this. The last slide, Maine Energy Pathways Analysis. I just wanted to speak briefly to some of the pieces that we're planning to undertake over the course of the next year. So this will be a study that the GO is preparing to launch, which will build upon the work of the Climate Council, the roadmap, and others, incorporate analysis of increasing Maine's usage of clean energy to stabilize electricity rates, diversify our sources of energy, fight climate change, and create jobs. So I wanted to make sure that this was also communicated to the committee.
Do you want questions before you go on to the next section, or
I defer to you. I'm happy to take questions. I'm going to pass the mic back to Stan.
Are there questions now on the slides we went over? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick one. So on page 17, the needs for the region 12 gigawatts by 2050. Can you get us a number on how many actual platforms that would be at whatever? I think it used to be 1,200, right? Size-wise.
but per platform, but I'm not sure what the new design might be. So
yeah, I'd be happy to follow up with that.
Representative Geiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure I'm still understanding the plan. As I understand it, Maine has control 3 miles out, and that's it. And as part of that, Maine has taken the step to say we will not have wind within those 3 miles, which would probably be embedded in the seafloor. We've taken that off the table. The feds are the ones who control the Gulf of Maine. They have already said that they're putting this out to bid. They expect to grant those bids with it by the end of 2024. So that's all happening. And so Maine's role is to try and make sure that we get the research array so that we can begin feeding data to the federal winners of those contracts about what needs to happen in the Gulf to protect whales, to protect our fishing industry, birds, everything. But we also have an opportunity because of the University of Maine's work developing floating turbines to be a leader in wind, to have the jobs and the electricity flowing through Maine, and that we have fierce competition from the little state of New Hampshire with all of its 20 miles of seacoast would also like to do that. So I just think it's important for all of us to remember that there are lots of things in the air, some of which we control, some of which is an incredible opportunity, and some of which we can sort of gum up the works to the detriment of our future in this state, but we won't be gumming up the works for the feds. It's going to happen whether we like it or not, but we can be a player in it and a participant and have the ability to give them feedback about how to do this in a way that works for Maine. Is that your understanding as well? See, I got a question in there.
Good job.
And you don't need to ask questions at this point. This is just a briefing, so you can ask for their reaction to that.
I think that's exactly right.
Good. Do you want to sit up there with them? Other questions, comments at this point? Senator Grahowski.
Thank you. I'm looking back on the map that you had of the draft call area on slide 11 and just thinking about those possible 12 gigawatts. I just don't know enough about the federal process. Would they ever change? I mean, this is just the current draft call, but could they change it in the future so that those 12 gigawatts were not just confined to this area? Could they come inshore up to the 3 mile zone? Or did you know enough about how that, like, is this sort of the biggest extent, or would they still tweak it in the future possibly? Or do we not know?
For this leasing round in 2024, this is the maximum area. This is the area that could possibly be included there. The BOEM also has a planning area for the Gulf of Maine that goes to the 3 mile line. And so in the future, they could, if they wanted to, I don't know that they would, but they technically could go up to that 3 mile. The state controls the 3 miles to coastline. Does that answer your question?
Okay. I think so. I mean, I was just curious. I was just trying to understand if it's maybe 12 gigawatts where they might all be, but I just didn't know if they could encroach more than what they've said here. And it sounds like yes, in a future draft call area they could, but this is what we know for now.
Yeah, and unlikely, I think.
Okay. Thanks.
Set. Other questions at this point? Representative Boyle?
You said, I heard you say a one spin of the turbine can power two homes. For a day, I think you said something like that. Can you find out for and get back to me how far I can drive my Chevy Bolt with one spin of the blade?
A good one.
That'd be good to know.
What model year is your Bolt? Thank you.
And probably Representative. By the time they get back to you, the technology will have changed, so they're going to have to recalculate, and it's changing pretty dramatically. So I do have a question on one of your charts, and I'm referring back to this one on page 14. So this looks at, if I understand it correctly, what we're currently in our various classes with DG procurement, Class 1A procurement, eligible hire grow, existing 1 and 1A. And I see these circles as that's where we need to get to with class 1 and 1A procurement, which this would fall into, obviously. So do I deduce right from here that pretty soon by 2025 and 2026, we're going to be exceeding our current procurements and we need additional procurements to meet these future needs? Is that correct?
It's a very astute reading of that chart. And I would say that it was produced in 2020. And so what's not reflected there are things like the Northern Maine Renewable okay. Energy Development Program that came yep. later. I think the broader conclusion that we need to continue to build new renewable energy to meet our goals by 2030 okay. is very true.
I'm just trying to frame it for our committee because it seems like we need to start to think about new procurements for sources of renewable energy at this point in order to meet it in those outlying years.
I would say that that 2020 study and the analysis that was produced for the roadmap both support that conclusion.
Okay, thank you. Representative Warren?
Just in soliciting input from people, I guess, involved with the legislature, I've heard a variety of opinions about that moratorium for the next 10 years, state waters. Is this pathway or is there other related work that you're going to get to in this presentation about the benefits of having offshore wind within that within our state waters? And is that something that you're considering? I know there's certain constituencies that have probably some very legitimate concerns. Just trying to understand where you're at in the stakeholder process and how you solicit a variety of perspectives and I guess how you might go forward and include everyone and find a way to a compromise beyond a moratorium. Or maybe there's not one. Maybe there's not a need for that, if, even to meet our climate goals.
Thanks for the question. I have not heard specifically about people interested in seeing development within 3 miles, but happy to have a conversation if there are specific people who you know about that. I think generally the industry has been pushing a little bit further out, given the sheer size of the turbines, but the legislature took action on the prohibition, and happy to hear more if it's an area of discussion.
Representative Warren?
So no, that's good to know. I've mostly, I guess I've heard strong opponents by those in the fishing communities and industry, but you know, everyone needs power. So, and we're all trying to reach this goal. So just trying to understand, it sounds like from what you're saying, there isn't a lot of need and it is quite safe and fair to maybe perhaps continue on beyond a 10-year moratorium, if you understand what I'm saying. Just because it is a 10-year, it seemed like it wasn't, it's not 10 years? Oh, it's permanent. Okay. So there's, oh, okay. Okay. Then forgive my ignorance. So there's no like stated reason or a constituency that does have any issue with that is maybe what I'm hearing.
I have not heard about that.
Other questions, Representative Foster?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So during discussions we had in the 130th on Zoom, I brought up my thoughts that the 3 mile legislation doesn't really matter, because at that point we were looking at offshore floating turbines that were around 600 feet. My calculations were that from a 6 foot tall person looking out across the ocean, he could see the top of that at something like 27 miles. Can you find out for us what the distance would be here that these would be able to be seen from the coast at sea level? If they are eight, I think you said they're how tall? 800 feet?
850. From what distance are you asking?
So if I'm standing on the beach in Old Orchard and I look out to sea, how far away will I be able to see the top of this?
Okay.
It's a very simple calculation, but my captain is not available. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm happy to get back to you.
We'll get Bowditch from.
Other questions at this point? Mm-hmm. Representative Warren and then Representative Grahowski, and then we'll let you finish with your presentation.
As far as that longer term planning, let's say to get to 100% clean energy by 2040, that moves up your timeline by 10 years, it seems like. Does that change your calculus as far as getting different, especially maybe local governments on board. It sounds like that's something that so far hasn't been done. Based, maybe I'm misunderstanding your answer to my question previously, but does that mean you're going to need a whole bunch more resources to get that stakeholder engagement or anything like that? Could you speak to that planning work just on getting buy-in from people who might be critical for whatever reason?
Sure. Thank you for the question. I'd say that we've certainly learned from our work on the roadmap through the Climate Council Energy Working Group that having dialogue and stakeholder engagement, not only in those forums, but also going to municipal association or other forums to meet and talk to people is really important. So that will be embedded in the work that we do. I think the specific proposal that or process that Ethan talked about will certainly include stakeholder engagement and will be informed by all the work that we have here.
And just to clarify for Representative Warren a little, what they're doing is essentially a roadmap. It's a study of planning. The decision on moving forward with renewables really is ours and our direction to the PUC. So we'll be having those discussions and we'll be having those interested parties here to talk about their concerns. This is not something they're going to go ahead and do. It's really at the PUC level that it has to be done. And really am directed by the legislature.
I guess maybe it's a question to put out there, maybe for you guys, or maybe you'd have a response to it. In order to give us a good plan, my thought, maybe in ignorance or I'm making assumptions, would be that they would go out and talk to every town and legislator that's involved. But to be frank, at least so far, the people, there's quite a few, at least colleagues of mine, that are quite critical and they've never heard from you guys. And I hear you because I'm on this committee, but you know, there's reasons why various people get put on different committees. And if my town's not having an issue with it, that makes my vote maybe a little bit easier, to be frank, if I could just hold it on record. So I guess part of my question is or maybe it's a question for you, as part of that process of putting together an ideal plan, do you engage with those maybe thorny conversations or maybe the politics of what a local community has an issue with as far as the advice that you give us? Maybe I'm asking you to make our jobs easier, but maybe that's a question I'd have.
I mean, Selena's going to talk more about the roadmap and who was involved and sort of the makeup of the advisory committee and others in a minute here, but I do want to just say that municipal leaders and local leaders were quite involved in the development of the roadmap and provided quite a bit of input. There's always more, and at different stages of the process, there are different avenues to give input. And so it is important to us that we're hearing from folks at other levels of municipal government or otherwise, but I don't want us to suggest that they weren't involved in the creation of the roadmap or something like that, but I'll also maybe turn it back to Selena to tell you more about the composition of kind of how that's.
Why don't you go ahead, Selena?
Okay, great. So we are on, can you tell us the slide number? The offshore wind roadmap slide, I think. Thank you.
19.
So in 2021, the Governor's Energy Office embarked on the development of an offshore wind roadmap. We received $2.2 million from the U.S. Economic Development Administration to put together a comprehensive plan to develop an offshore wind industry. And we really we formed an advisory committee and four working groups focused on specific subjects, and wanted to make sure that we had a broad cross-section of different interests, expertise, and industries represented to help us build this plan. And I should note that while many participants saw significant opportunity from offshore wind, we also had advisory committee members and working group members who did not support offshore wind, and we are very appreciative of the engagement and dialogue that we had in recognizing that they may not even support offshore wind, but I think broadly there was broad support on the advisory committee in the working groups. And so this work was also supported by state agencies, expert collaborators, and technical consultants. In total, we had nearly 100 public and private experts who spent 18 months developing recommendations and helping to put forward a thoughtful approach for the industry. We had multiple opportunities for public comments, including multiple formal public comment periods. We had 78 public meetings. All those meetings were open to the public. We put our meeting agendas online, meeting notes. And we also took an effort to, in addition to those meetings, having working group leaders go out and meet with a number of associations, industry leaders, tribes, NGOs, labor organizations, businesses to solicit informally solicit information. The overall the result of all of those 18 months is putting together the roadmap objectives, and you can see those here on this slide. Overall, the roadmap identifies five key objectives to responsibly advance offshore wind. This includes pursuing offshore wind supply chain infrastructure and workforce investments to support economic growth and resiliency, harnessing abundant renewable energy to reduce long-term costs and reliance on fossil fuels, advancing Maine-based innovation to compete in emerging national and global offshore wind industry, and supporting Maine's vital and thriving seafood industries and coastal communities, protecting the environment, wildlife, and ecosystem of the Gulf of Maine. In addition to those key objectives, we also had cross-cutting themes that were present throughout our discussions, which include stakeholder engagement and communication, equity, transparency, and data decision-making, and regional collaboration and coordination. So that is throughout the documented effort that we have been focused on. As there is obviously a tremendous opportunity to grow this industry, it's also important that we do so responsibly. So we want to make sure that we're preserving Maine's thriving marine economy, protecting the environment, and preserving Maine's traditions and culture. So the objectives I'll just briefly go through are not in any specific order, but I'll just want you to talk about each one in some detail. So objective A is about supply chain infrastructure and workforce and creating an abundant and accessible opportunities for Maine businesses, strategically investing in ports, manufacturing infrastructure, attracting investment and workforce to Maine necessary to support the industry, and ensuring opportunity and inclusivity in Maine's offshore wind workforce and developing opportunities for Maine businesses. We, as a part of this analysis, we conducted a supply chain analysis. We found that 80 companies in Maine are engaged or interested in engaging in the offshore wind industry. We have significant strength when it comes to secondary steel manufacturing and fabrication, engineering, permitting, surveying, and shipbuilding. And so we want to make sure that we are supporting businesses that are interested in engaging in the current offshore wind market and preparing future businesses to support in the growing Gulf of Maine market. We are also partnering or looking at opportunities to collaborate regionally so that we can benefit from projects elsewhere and maximize benefits to domestic, having a domestic supply chain, which is a priority for the federal government. We also launched a Maine supply chain registry to make sure that we are accounting for the companies interested in engaging, and we've held several trainings to help people understand what the offshore wind industry is and how they can be engaged in the marketplace. We also conducted a workforce training and education analysis to identify our strengths, some of which are on the slide there, and taking a look at our education and workforce development opportunities. The Governor's Energy Office also has established the Clean Energy Partnership with MJRP funding. We've issued a number of grants, including some to the University of Maine and the iron workers, to looking at training programs and curriculum development to advance, to make sure that we have Maine people who are ready to take on these new growing jobs. I wanted to bring you a Maine Maritime grad to talk about ports, but he's unfortunately unwell. So yeah, I'm happy to make him available for future briefing if you're interested. But I want to just say that there, offshore wind requires very specific criteria that is not common for other ports. And ports supporting both fixed and floating have a lot of similarities, but some differences. And so there, Maine is embarking on a path to identify a port for supporting the offshore wind port. The Department of Transportation has convened a stakeholder group with a number of representatives that you can see on that list there. Their meetings are publicly held and scheduled, and they had a meeting just last week or so, and we'll have another one this summer. And really looking at the different options in terms of where the port should be located, how it should be configured, and taking an input before making a final determination, and going through an effort to build out a purpose-built floating offshore wind facility. And port facilities are generally in very high demand to support the industry up and down the coast, and they can bring economic benefits when you have a port located and the jobs associated with that. And generally, you'll need a port with deep water access, no overhead restrictions, having sufficient space for a staging area with heavy load capability, and wharf frontage. So I included in the next slide just a couple of the different types of activities that can take place at a port, and just give you a sense of that. And then on the next slide, when you think about how you physically need to fabricate and deploy the technology, it's important to keep the size in mind, that these are really large platforms and turbines that you need to be thinking about when developing a port. So that's why we work with the Department of Transportation and the Maine Port Authority in that effort there. Objective B is establishing the strategies under Objective B. And I should note that in addition to these strategies, the full roadmap has detailed actions that also are underpinning these strategies. It includes establishing a state floating offshore wind procurement coordinated regionally to achieve cost-effective deployment, pursue regional transmission strategies, ensure a stable and predictable investment environment, and advocate for federal leasing mechanisms that supports Maine's goals. So there are several federal laws that provide once in a generation or maybe lifetime, I'm not sure, opportunity for federal funding to support clean energy investment. And so, as we mentioned a little bit, we're part of several efforts both in the state and also regionally to capitalize on those dollars, including regional transmission planning. We're also working with New York and other New England states on a proposal related to a clean hydrogen hub. And there is an interest in looking at clean hydrogen in connection to offshore wind globally. And so that's something that we have an eye on in understanding more about this. And then we recently submitted an application with in partnership with many Maine partners and regional partners to look at socioeconomic impacts of floating offshore wind with fishing communities. So making sure that we are supporting which was one of the recommendation of the fishing working group. So trying to maximize achieving the goals of the roadmap through the federal funds that are available. Objective C is continuing to develop the strategies include continuing to develop the Maine floating demonstration projects and leveraging Maine's R&D capabilities, establishing a floating hub, and leveraging Maine's existing capabilities around artificial intelligence, data science, and robotics, and working collaboratively on research to complement these technologies. We talked a little bit about the research array, but just want to make sure that folks have an introduction to this proposal. The Maine launched a proposal for the Maine Research Array in 2020 to advance our understanding of floating offshore wind and to support the development of homegrown technology and to understand key questions that we've talked a little bit about already today. So that's a key objectives of this research array. And as you can see there, it's a project that is about 44 miles from Portland and up to 12 turbines there. And I'll note that one thing that's important one highlight I want to make is that you see the next slide with this kind of oblong shape here. We went through an extensive nearly year process to get feedback on how to site this research array. And that includes holding workshops, public meetings, and one-on-one conversations to get local fishermen's knowledge. We didn't have very much information available about the type of activity going here, and those individual conversations is what helped us site this project. And that was a driving factor in citing that project. And in addition to looking at other issues like wildlife navigation, defense uses, and cost. So we have submitted an application that includes a comprehensive research framework to achieve our research objectives to the federal government. We hope that they have recently in March issued a determination of no competitive interest, and then are starting a national Environmental Policy Act review, and then hopefully we'll have a lease issuance to continue to advance that project. Objective D is around fisheries issues, and the strategies include strengthen and facilitate robust engagement and integrate technical feedback from fishermen, fishing businesses, and communities. promote open, transparent, and comprehensive research and data gathering, seek to avoid and then minimize conflicts, ensure safe navigation and opportunities for fair and equitable benefits. And I, one just example of the work that we're doing that came out of this working group is looking at our an offshore wind mapping effort, which is a stakeholder process, looking at the data that we have available in the Gulf of Maine and trying to make sure that we can, through conversation, taking a look at the data sources we have, how can we work with that data a little bit more to make sure that it's showing the information that would be most helpful to inform the siting process for the federal government. And so it's been an iterative process to develop better mapping and identify future needs around data gathering. And lastly, last but not least, is environment, wildlife, fisheries, ecosystem protection. And I just say that there include collect high quality relevant data that's publicly available, proactively reduce conflicts, facilitate timely permitting, strengthening Maine's state policy framework, enhancing regional collaboration, support state and other funding, transparent engagement, and promote and advance new technologies. Through that work, and obviously the work of the legislature, we have established the Maine Offshore Wind Consortium, which is part of our overall commitment to advance responsible offshore wind industry. The offshore wind industry, and we are coordinating with DMR and other state agencies in the advancement of this effort. Overall, the consortium is focused on three priorities, including identifying opportunities and challenges to existing uses in the Gulf of Maine, including how best to support coexistence with the fishing industry, methods to avoid and minimize impacts on ecosystems and existing uses, and ways to realize cost efficiency. And so we went through a multi-month process to get a competitive through a competitive RFP to get a consultant on board to go through interviews and conversations with stakeholders and how to shape the consortium to make sure that it is effective, it reaches our goals, and also doesn't duplicate other efforts. And so through that dialogue, we established a path forward for the development of the consortium, held the first consortium advisory committee meeting in February, and then another one on Monday. This week. And if you go to the next slide, you can see the members that are on the advisory committee, which is a broad set of interests. And what we will do over the next coming months is continuing to narrow in on the research priorities for the research consortium, and then issue an RFP, competitive RFP, for funding to support research related to offshore wind soon. So that work is underway. And then I just say that this presentation is a snapshot in the ongoing work of the state of Maine to capture what we think is an important economic opportunity for the state. And we are committed to iterating on this work and working with stakeholders to responsibly advance offshore wind in the state. So thank you very much for taking the time to listen through those slides.
Final questions for the GEO? So when we look for community input and on the research consortium, the fishing industry are those first people you mentioned, two from the lobstering industry, Maine Coast Fishermen's, O'Hara Corp, the Bluefin Tuna Association, Sports Ventures. Those are the ones from the fishing industry, correct?
Correct.
And then to go to Representative Warren's point, the next are coastal community members. You have somebody from the Portland Waterfront Coordinator and then an additional member to be determined. That's where their input comes in. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Other questions? Representative Grochowski. Senator Grochowski, sorry.
No worries. Thank you for this overview. I've been trying to keep up, but there's a lot of other things that we all have to deal with. One of the things that I am excited about the research consortium and how we tried to frame that in statute. And I appreciate that you guys are trying to make progress on that. It just feels to me like it's a little slow. And I say that because I believe we authorized that money back in 2021. And it's now had two meetings. And I was able to attend part of the meeting on Monday, in which the part that I attended, a lot of it did have like breakout groups that I couldn't be a part of, I think, due to the virtual aspect. But, you know, they were talking about conflict of interest policies, things that were very like organizational in fashion. And so I wondered if you guys could comment on when you think the consortium is actually going to dig into less of organizing principles and more of what are we actually going to do if we get this research array approved, because we need to be gathering baseline data now, I think, or at least discussing what that research plan looks like. So I just wonder if you could comment on the reason for the delay, and then what are we going to do to actually accelerate this process now that it's finally been meeting?
Sure. Thank you for the question. So I can share a little bit about what we've been doing in the interim and then the plan for the future. So in February of last year, we issued a RFP, got a consultant on board, and then from March until November, had 35 extensive interviews, put together a scope, structure, and governance of implementation strategy of how to form this consortium to achieve the goals. In the meantime, we also had the research questions, which we feel like we had a good list of them. And the challenge is actually narrowing down to how to invest the dollars that we do have. And then we wanted to make sure that we had an open process for allowing advisory committee members. And so we publicly posted to see if anyone was interested in joining. And we got feedback that way and people who engaged. And then we held a meeting 2 months later. And so we've been working diligently through the process to make sure that we have a structure that not only works to achieve their goals, but is supported by the people who are involved and people that are willing to come to the table. We have plans to issue an RFP later this year. And I will note that we are very supportive, you know, appreciate the funding that has been offered. It's going to go through to not only supporting the entity, but also important research. We want to make sure that we are maximizing that. Doing offshore wind baseline data collection 40 miles offshore is not a cheap undertaking. So those dollars will go quickly, and we want to use them effectively and to achieve goals and start using them to match federal dollars and other federal grants and other grant opportunities too. So it is a key priority for our office to achieve results this year from that work.
Senator Borowski.
Thank you for sharing a little more about the background efforts there. I think I saw that DMR had put out probably was an RFP. I'm not sure what the exact structure was, but to have people that have vessels apply to them to do some of this research. In what way is that being coordinated with the consortium? And then additionally, what is the funding for that? And how is that separate from the consortium? Is it part of it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, okay. I can say generally, DMR is a key partner in this, and we are coordinating very closely on any studies that we do, particularly when it is. So yes, we work very closely. We're aware of that work, and they, I think, have separate funding available to do some of the work related to that. So I can't comment on that, but happy to get back to you on that. And we would certainly look for opportunities to leverage resources, consortium resources, with DMR's work, if that answers your question.
And the RFP you plan to be putting out this year, what's that going to cover?
That's really up to the advisory committee in terms of where are state dollars best spent right now to help inform the research array project, or to help inform how to minimize impacts from offshore wind. So I think items like baseline data collection could be a key area of focus for the research array that go above and beyond what would be required for federal permitting.
And are you looking at what kind of studies have already been done so you're not duplicating things, and what kind of studies need to be done?
That's a key part of this work, is that we are part of a regional wildlife and fisheries organizations, and really want to fine tune where is our dollars best spent.
And that's part of what the process is going on now, defining what that RFP is going to be.
Yes.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Representative Boyle.
Thank you. I love this slide with all the different size turbines on it and the bridge and everything. But Is it, it says theoretical for this huge 50 megawatt one turbine. I'm not going to ask how far my car will get because I may never need to plug it in again. But is that, when you say theoretical, is that like in 2050? How far out are we from 2023 to something like that?
I'll say I've heard the industry talking about 20 megawatts. So I think that 50 is a bit of a, yeah.
And so going back to Representative Foster's question on the research array and looking at this, so we should send him to, I'm trying to think what that point is, Cape Small to stand there and look out 28.8 miles to see if he can see the turbines from the research array once they're built. Is that correct?
On a clear day.
On a clear day. So we'll just get an exploratory mission set up now for Representative Foster to report bipartisan to report back to the committee on what he sees. Representative Foster?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to report back to the committee that the hub at 850 feet off the water can be seen from Old Orchard Beach by a 6 foot tall person at a distance of 36 miles. The Representative Boyle's turbine on page 10 at 448 meters, the tip could be seen at 47 miles. Thank you.
We have our expert.
If there's no one to know, we have these charts.
Thank you very much for coming and doing this presentation.
Thank you.
Okay.
I had another question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Grochowski has another question.
Sorry, I just got off track with that last one. I was wondering, though, is there any research that the state has undertaken at this point, or will that DMR RFP be the first that's happened as pertains to offshore wind development?
I think in we have, through the development of the research framework that we put forward, we did extensive analysis of what is available and what areas that we want to do research. So in terms of direct research, I believe that DMR has made investments prior to that RFP, but I'm happy to check in on that.
So it'd be safe to say so far there's sort of been a review of what exists, but no additional data collected to inform this process specifically.
DMR has done some data collection. Okay. They have ongoing funding to support data collection, so they have done some work. The federal government is also doing some work related to data collection to support its decision. So there has been ongoing work to some extent, but not specific to the funding that has been provided to GEO.
Okay. And then my final question is, obviously, getting the consortium set up and structured how everyone feels comfortable, sort of like a front end cost in a way. Once this consortium is more underway, what percent of funding do you think is going to go mostly to administrative costs versus actual research or grants to do research by other entities?
We want to make sure that we are not overly investing in administrative services, although it is an additional effort to undertake in order to do so. It would depend on, in terms of the percentage, probably depend on, we'll have to figure that out in terms of how much extra external federal or other sources we can raise. And that's a key part of this, is in addition to spending the money, how can we raise additional money to maximize that?
Now I do have another question. I remember that when we were having our budget discussion, there was, I don't remember if it was maybe $2.5 million of federal money, something like that, that the GEO was going to try to access, and you needed about $500,000 to access that money, and it would go for wind research. Is there an update on where that is in the process? And if any of those numbers are wrong, please correct me.
I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I can't correct you on the specific numbers, but I will say that GEO led an effort with Maine Fishing Associations, DMR, and others to put forward an application to the Department of Energy that was submitted, I think, 2 weeks ago, and is taking a really important step forward in terms of achieving some of the priorities of the roadmap and the fishing working group in terms of understanding economic impacts from into fishing communities. So that's just one example. And we do need, there is a match requirement from that. So the consortium is a good way to leverage that. We'll need to get an answer from DOE before we can commit those dollars. I'm sorry.
Is there a timeline that the federal government has given you for that answer?
I want to say this summer.
Okay. Thank you.
And can you give us an idea of the amount of money involved from the feds potentially?
It was in the 2.1 million.
Okay, great. Thank you. Other questions? Speak now or forever hold your peace. Representative Boyle.
Thank you. I'm interested in this renewable energy authorization process slide with the red box and the from zero to all the way out to the end. Depending on the green part has zero to less than five, so it could take less time. But if you add them all up, assuming that middle piece takes 5 years, that's about 12 years from start to finish. Is that correct?
Which everything? Chart are you on it's, to tell us?
Number nine, it's kind of a rainbow bar, slide number nine. Ethan had reviewed it earlier, I believe.
You're right that this is about approximately 10 years, but this can vary dramatically project by project or location by location. But it's a long time between leasing to actual projects in the water.
Yeah, follow-up. If everybody's kind of starting from this point in 2023 today, can you give us a sense of how long it might be before a commercially operable facility in that green mapped area would be in place, and then how much longer it might take to get all the way up to the something like 12 gigawatts that New England needs?
BOEM has estimated that it would be 4 to 6 years after lease issuance that there could be park projects in the water. That's a pretty aggressive timeline, but that's the timeline they provide. And BOEM hasn't indicated how many gigawatts that of areas that they will lease here. So that is to be determined. And then they can always hold future lease sales down the road to get to the 2050 required goals that New England has set.
Other questions? Seeing none, again, thank you very much for coming and doing this presentation. I'm going to suggest before we get into our work sessions, we take our little break now for 15 minutes and we'll come back and work.